Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, and welcome to this week's FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery, and very excited this week because Mike is here in person with me here in Chicago.
Yeah, and I'm kind of wired up because I finally got over my jet lag. It is actually pretty hard to cope with nearly 24 hours of travel without kind of being flipped out and wanting to sleep in the middle of the afternoon.
That second day is a bitch.
Yeah, but hey, you know, I'm good.
And Mike is here because doing a little bit of prep to hang out in Chicago a little bit before we head to SIGGRAPH next week, and where we're going to be doing multiple FX Guide podcasts on the net.
Yeah, we've just got an astonishing array, John, of really great podcast interviews and stuff lined up. We basically, as you know, we do the FX Guide podcast. We also do FX Guide TV and other things. And the FX Guide TV at SIGGRAPH last year was a real milestone for us because we were putting out podcasts every day. And again, this year, we're going to be putting out multiple podcasts from SIGGRAPH, and I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, and if you want to know when those things get out, updated automatically on the website, be sure to visit the podcast page where you can subscribe either via iTunes if you use iTunes, or if you don't use iTunes, subscribe to the RS feed. And you'll get automatically notified when we have those out because we'll be, you know, putting them out consistently during the week, little apps. It's going to be a lot of fun. So looking forward to hanging in LA with you and Jeff.
Yeah, it'll be great. It really, really is one of the most outstanding conferences for sort of proper research education stuff. And I've got to say, I don't want to be too much of a tease, but we've started getting the NDA material. We get a lot of material that's under embargo that can't go out until obviously later in SIGGRAPH week. And we get to see it, of course, before it happens so we can put the shows together. And oh my God, some of the stuff that we've been looking at yesterday, it's groundbreaking. It really is like redefining, isn't it?
Yeah, it's going to be fantastic. Some amazing stuff, especially when you consider it's kind of building on some stuff that we saw last year at SIGGRAPH and so forth. And it's amazing how far it's come in simply a year. So it's going to be fun to share that with everyone in FX Guide TV and articles and so forth. And we'll be Twittering that as well. The main one, Mike, what's your Twitter for?
So my Twitter is www, you know, whatever it is, twitter.com/Mike Seymour. And it'd be good for a couple more people to join because I'm like it. We're going to be putting out regular sort of Twitters throughout SIGGRAPH as we did at NAB, and people found that kind of useful. So, you know, as if you can't get there, as the event rolls out from each of the press conferences and after various interviews and stuff, we'll just sing. So it's kind of it is a bit of an insider thing. We tend to post stuff there that we don't post anywhere else, so you get a hint of what's coming.
And my Twitter feed is JohnMontFX, and Jeff's is, I can't remember what Jeff's is.
I can find
well,
you, Jeff.
Yeah, we'll, it's on the internet. So and I'll be Twittering as
Jeff's
well.
Jeff's is Neon Marg, NEONMARG.
And we'll all be, there's so much to do that we'll be separating up. So we'll be
multiple teams
talking about what we're doing. So that's going to be a lot of fun. But hey, let's get somewhat to our podcast this week. But it's somewhat related to our podcast last week on some of the labor issues that happened and Jeff's podcast, which really got a really great string of comments from people. I think it really hit home with a lot of artists in our audience.
And I just wanted to follow up on that podcast from last week, because if you recall, there was a discussion about the fact that Dave had been trying to get hold of Brendan Fraser, and he was actually not only the star of the film, but one of the executive producers. And, you know, there was a sort of a, he tried to get hold of him, hadn't got anywhere, didn't know if that was going. Well, since that has happened, the New York Post picked up the story. Also, we understand, I think I'm right in saying this, that, well, I know for a fact that Brendan Fraser has now started communicating with Dave, and they're helping out. And he's made multiple phone calls and really starting to take a role in seeing if he can do anything to help, which is terrific. But I also believe, I think I'm right in saying this, that that Dave mentioned that Brendan actually listened to the podcast that Jeff did when he went over to Tokyo. I think I'm right in saying that. So anyway, it's great that there's some movement there. It's starting to pick up, and that's a really important story. And we consider these stories, these labor stories that Jeff's doing, is some of the, you know, really important work that FX Guide can do. So we're very happy to support it. And as you know, there are three in the series, and they're rolling out over the next coming weeks. This week, however, is not another one of those, because we're not going to do three in a row. We're going to do them, you know, interspersed with our normal regular FX podcasts. And just to balance out, in case there was any misconception about our attitude towards the film, which, you know, was almost coincidentally at the center of the story. And we, as we said last week in the podcast, Dave and no one else wants to dump on the film. And we thought that we'd balance out with an actual interview about another aspect of the film that was interesting, the stereoscopic nature of the DI grading. So a completely sort of parallel issue, I guess, is just what happened in that film in terms of its technology, because it was breakthrough, and it is something that probably deserves discussion. And we sat down with Jeff Ohm, who's actually also one of the professors at FX PhD, and discussed with him, because he was one of the key members of the stereoscopic / DI team. He graded the film, but the grading of the film, as you'll hear, John, actually entails adjusting and working with the stereoscopic effect. And he did all of that in his suite, which was a custom-built suite for the purpose, and using Scratch.
Yeah, so why don't we go ahead and join that conversation you had recently with Jeff.
So this is truly a phenomenally interesting film at so many levels. I guess the most obvious factor about it is the nature of it being a stereoscopic film. When did you first hear about the project?
I first heard about the project last year, about this time last year in July, and I was approached by Lucas Wilson from Assimilate. They were looking at using the Scratch system on Journey 3D because it was one of the few systems that had the capabilities at the time. So Lucas called me. I talked to Steve Kaminsky, who was the post-supervisor on the project, and we did an interview, and Steve was putting together the team, which had Gary Jackamuck, which was somebody that I had worked with at Digital Domain, and Michael Fellows, who was part of the Superman team with Steve and Gary. And together it was, you know, kind of a three-person team initially, Mike doing the I.O., Gary doing the conforming, and kind of, you know, doing the management things, and allowed me to concentrate on doing the color and working directly with the DP director and visual effects supervisor to take care of the images.
Now, of course, your background was stretching back from not just color grading and stuff, but you've got a huge run of visual effects films to your credit. When was it that you started moving out from doing compositing work into these more aesthetic areas such as grading and stuff?
I was real lucky. I took a job with Autodesk in 2003 and signed on as the Flame demo artist or application engineer. And I was, just as I signed on, they signed the deal with Colorfront and moved the Colorfront system, Colossus, over to Autodesk. And because I had all that film experience, Dave Sampson, the Western Regional Manager, said, "Hey, you got the film experience, you're now the luster guy." And I was the only guy on the West Coast that was truly a trained luster operator, and went about testifying about how, and this is in 2003, how the things that software grading and software color correction was going to be the future. And once people started using these software color correction systems, there was going to be no turning back. It would basically replace film color timing. And here we are 5 years later, and 80% of the films that are greenlit now have a DI in their budget.
So your position on this film is interesting, I guess, because the production decided to really set up its own unit for doing the grading and sort of final stereoscopic work. So you actually had your own, the team had their own suite and their entire own set of gear, as opposed to it being part of a major separate facility.
Yeah, and it was nice that you came by when you're in town, that Lucas brought you by. It was a 100-seat theater. It was on the old MGM lot, actually called the Lot in West Hollywood. And the studio decided that because nobody could bring anything to, none of the Ascent Media didn't have a stereo solution, Technicolor had no stereo solution, and the Pablo wasn't out in stereo, because really the only place in town now that can offer the stereo grading that is done like Hannah Montana is Photochem, and they have a cluster of four Pablos and things that they're going through, doing things right now. But at the time, a year ago, there wasn't any solutions that were available. So the studio decided to purchase four Scratch systems, a 20 terabyte Facilis file share system, and a couple small software Avids. And we put the whole operation together in the theater. And basically, we'd get FireWire drives in, SR tapes in, and digitized everything through the Bluefish card in the Scratch HP 8600s, and we were a complete self-contained facility, all in a 100-seat theater.
Yeah, I mean the setup there was interesting, and obviously technically, you know, you've done a lot of work to set up. But I mean, one of the funniest things walking in is just seeing cardboard cutouts in the actual seats. But this was like really an environment which you were trying to simulate as much as possible the experience for the audience.
Yeah, that was real important. Eric Brevig, you know, he talked about my visual effects experience. Eric Brevig was the director, and he's an Academy Award winner from The Abyss when he was at DreamQuest, and then he went on to do second unit directing on Men in Black and Wild Wild West and things like that. So Eric and I had the common ground of the visual effects background, and for a shot that had, you know, over 850 visual effects, you know, that was a great common bond to have. So what Eric felt was important in the theater was that he saw how the audience would see it, and that was one of the things that we wanted to do, was basically immerse the audience in the film. And we accomplished that by grading it in a environment that was a 30-foot screen, you know, a little bit smaller theater, but a 100-seat theater. But it was, you know, my workstation was set up, you know, right at the sweet spot, about, you know, 12 rows back, and it was very important that, you know, we had those cardboard cutouts there, so that when Eric would take his laser pointer to figure out where the image was in three space, as he called it, he could judge by the heads of the, you know, kind of the fake audience that we had there. So it was a unique environment, you know, had surround sound in it, great audio, crank the tunes in it, and, you know, work a long day, and it was a great environment.
But as is the nature with stereoscopic work, you, in fact, had a, you know, large, I think, fairly monster container of Advil, I think, sitting on the desk from when you first started setting it up and when you're sort of working out the kinks. Because, you know, it's not putting it too mildly to say that if you get stereoscopic stuff wrong, or you don't know what you're doing in the whims of the workflow in the early stages, if things aren't working right, you can really literally give the client a headache.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that one of the first things I tell the new software vendors that are getting into the stereo situations is you have to make sure that the images stay together, stay locked. You have to make sure that the graphics go up on both eyes and that you can grade in both eyes and things like that. So, yeah, definitely the first couple months while we were working out the editorial process, while the software was coming up to speed, I had, you know, Excedrin migraine container there, and we were just whipping right through that. And basically, you know, that's the whole reason why some of the previous 3D systems didn't really have, you know, gained traction. You had two film projectors that were moving all over, and one of the biggest problems with stereo is either too much divergence of the image, that it's, you know, it's too far and it hurts and your eyes can't correct for it, or if there's any vertical misalignment, or if in a film projector, the film projectors would slip out of sync. And when it's one frame out of sync, it was a huge issue. And every once in a while we were doing the conform in the initial stages of the first preview, which I feel really did a bang-up job. And Jonas Thaler, the VP of post-production for Walden, we put together the first preview screening in about 2.5 weeks. And, you know, everybody was, you know, very happy and, I think, quite surprised that we were able to come off with a top-quality preview screening from something that the studio had bought and kind of put together with, you know, just the help of a, you know, a hardware vendor and then assimilate as a software vendor.
I must say, Jonas is quoted as saying that it was like looking through a picture window, that you feel like you can sort of step into the action. And by the time I turned up to visit you on location, as it were, at the grading suite, it was down to a fine art, and you're really disciplined in terms of glasses on and glasses off. But when it was working and you had the glasses on, it really did feel like a window onto, you know, something that you could step into, because it is such a viscerally different experience than watching it mono.
Yeah, and that was one of the nice things about that theater. The configuration that we had in that theater was dual NEC 2K projectors with circular polarizers, which is a different experience than the Real D setup. You know, not to put the Real D system, you know, it is second to the theme park experience, which is what we had in that theater, which was the two NEC projectors, circular polarizers at 14-foot Lamberts. The Real D system, which is a single projector and a Z-screen polarizer, will go anywhere between 3.5 and 5 foot Lamberts. So, you know, you're getting about 10 more foot Lamberts almost with this dual setup. So, and that was what Eric wanted, because he wanted to view the visual effects shots as uncompressed shots and basically, you know, judge everything at the best quality, so that at the end of the day, when we would do the distribution and deliverables, that we were basically taking a very high quality master and resizing and packaging up very high quality products.
Yeah, it worked really well. Now let's walk through the workflow that got to that room. So for a start, you were shooting, or the production was shooting digitally. Can you just tell us about the cameras and what files were actually being recorded on set?
Yeah, what they used was the Vince Pace and James Cameron Fusion rig, which is a two-camera rig that has the Sony 950, just the camera heads and lenses on it. The CCUs are actually, you know, will then go through a camera cable and then be off on the camera cart. And there'll be a lot of different cable configurations. Vince has, you know, been doing this for years. He'll take those cameras, you know, down underwater. They actually use the underwater housings on this, because there's a couple spectacular. I think some of the best shots in the movie are, you know, some of the underwater sequences that there are. So it was the two 950 cameras with SR1 decks. And then the cameras would record each to their own deck, 444, with stripe time code. Would, you know, time code would be slaved to both decks, so it was always the same. There was metadata that was included on the tapes that took into account and noted the focal lengths, you know, any of the image, you know, image information that you could cram into the DPX files. You know, was utilized in that fashion. And then once they took the SR tapes, they would put them up on, they actually used a similar configuration, I think the same projectors we used to grade on. They built a dailies setup on location in Montreal, and they used that same setup, and they would play back these SR tapes, you know, just to make just to do a quality check and make sure that they had everything, and that they were happy with the way the convergence was working and such. And later on, they moved to some, you know, other stereo ways to check the dailies and things like that. But yeah, they were checking uncompressed dailies off the SR tapes right there on location in the field. And then we basically took that same projector configuration and set it up in the theater. So it was always the same kind of hardware, you know, being utilized to monitor the quality throughout the process.
And then when you were actually working, you were taking on effectively dual functions, because you were doing the color grading to obviously set up the thematic arcs and the underlying kind of mood of the shots as you would with a normal film. But then you were also adjusting the stereoscopic convergence dynamically for the director, weren't you?
Yeah, and that was one of the other great things about Eric, was that he had the experience from Captain EO, and this was my first stereo show. So I had just finished The Bronx is Burning, which I did location color grading, and then I went over to CBS Digital and actually did visual effects on The Flame, which is, you know, pretty unique to do the dailies on the front end and then come back and finish visual effects. And I went straight from The Bronx is Burning to this show, and then Eric would basically schooled me on how stereo should look, what works, what doesn't work. And we also had a great editorial team, Dirk Westervel, and was one of the editors that would come in, and they had gone through and done these convergence fixes with hand notes, screening in a theater, then driving 15 minutes back to the Avid and did manual convergence fixes.
Wow.
So by the time we got on the scene and we could do real-time convergence fixes on the scratch, they just thought, you know, it was great. And the other person I have to mention is Ed Marsh, who was the visual effects editor, and he had worked with Jim Cameron on Ghost of the Abyss and things like that. So there was a lot of things that were figured out stereo-wise from the previews they had done on the Avid DSs, where they had done manual adjustments, we would actually take those axis adjustments and then load them up in the Scratch. So I had a pretty good starting point, and I had a pretty good idea from the EDL what shots were problem shots that we really needed to address first for that first preview screening.
Well, the other thing that was I'd love you to tell us about is the use of the laser pointer when you're sitting there with the director and his idea of, you know, what should be where in terms of that that space and how you adjust it accordingly with Scratch.
The interesting things is, you know, with the glasses on, your eyes will compensate for a lot, and that's basically how 3D works. So if the image is very diverged, the process of your eyes resolving it is what creates the 3D for you in space and separates the elements. By placing the laser pointer on the screen, what you're able to do is locate in 3D space, or three spaces, Eric would call it, locate where the screen plane was. So everything is in relation to the screen plane. The background objects, so let's say, you know, you're shooting an exterior and there's rocks in the background. The rocks will be split out. The left eye stuff will be on the left. The right eye stuff will be on the right. And then the image at the screen plane is actually an absolute overlay and may look like a normal picture. And normally they'll position the talent at that. And then, you know, especially in movies or projects like U2, where they had the waving arms and things like that, you know, those are foreground objects, and those will normally be split by the left eye will be positioned, the image will appear positioned to the right, and the right will be positioned to the left. So you have, you know, these three tiers of 3D space, normally the talent being converged at the screen plane, and then, you know, you just all of a sudden have this, you know, great experience of, okay, look at those cool foreground arms. Okay, cool, look at, there's Bono, and he's, you know, not ghosting and on the screen plane and looks spectacular, and then he's going to point his arm at you, and that's going to come out over the arms. And that's basically, you know, kind of the gag in the whole process is creating those three dimensions and then kind of working it. And in our case, instead of working it with the music, we had to work it with the story, work it through, you know, various moments with the audience to create a sense of excitement and an overall enjoyable viewing experience.
Yeah. I guess it was, it's a funny thing, isn't it? Because there's multiple things going on when you're watching a stereoscopic image. And one of the things that I guess has become somewhat of an issue is the idea of depth of field. Because while when shooting with those particular cameras, you'd had good depth of field, there's a sort of a query, I guess, out there in the industry is whether or not you can have shallow depth of field for a filmic look when you have a natural inclination as an audience to want to look around inside a 3D stereoscopic frame. Did you know, creatively and stuff, did any of those things come into play? I mean, how much were you sort of doing this as a 3D thing, and how much were you just worrying about the story first and everything else is kind of following through?
Well, you would basically, with everything, it should always be story first. Many times that when I get to it in the process, and you know how visual effects are, you may not see the, you know, parts of the film, or you're just working on a small section. The nice thing about this was, is, you know, I was working on the whole film. I had read the script. I had seen the preview screenings and things like that. So if there were certain things that popped up, I will say in this particular situation, because I was on the project for over 6 months and in on the visual effects dailies and things like that, there were things I was able to point out where, hey, we're going to need mats for this, or why don't we have visual effects go another round, or try and help them out where, okay, I can fix that. If they give me a mat, we can final this shot now, and then we can just fix this and make this stuff go together later. So a big overall global picture is really great to have, and it was a pleasure to have that on this particular project. And I had said this to somebody the other day. I said one of the things you can't fix in the DI, especially a DI that you're just in on the last 3 weeks, is you can't fix story in DI. It is going to be what it is, and then it all comes down to You know, the images and, you know, and what you can do to make it, you know, pleasing on the eye, and, you know, just a great viewing experience. And, you know, that was always my real goal with it. And when I read the reviews and things like that, I know the reviews are going to, you know, say story and things like that sometimes because, you know, it's a fluff popcorn family film and very enjoyable. But, you know, that's it, it is what it is. You know, that's what the market is a family film. Take everybody to it, and everybody has a good time. And the thing I like about it is when the reviewers say that it was a eye-pleasing experience, eye candy, visual, you know, nice things. That's really what makes me feel good about, you know, my involvement in the whole project.
I guess what I was getting at is, like, how much were you because there's a sense of the 3D effect being a gag, and it didn't seem to me that you were playing for gags. There are obviously occasions where you were dramatically doing stuff with the 3D stereoscopic stuff, but it seemed to me that there was some, you know, the underneath stuff, like, you know, where, for example, they're being towed along in the on the I'm going to call it the ocean, but, you know, the water, and the attack of the fish comes out and stuff. I mean, that was great, and it was fun, and it was obviously using the 3D effect, but it wasn't like it was a gag reel film in terms of 3D effects. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you know, basically what everybody looks for in these pictures, you know, from the studio side, from the directorial side, studio side, and the experience side is, hey, it's a 3D film. I paid, you know, extra money for the glasses, and you expect certain 3D moments, and you know, those moments take in shot design. You know, you think it's like, okay, well, this will be great. We can have an excellent foreground object that can where we can create extra dimension, and it'll give the viewing audience a great experience of, you know, a great 3D experience. So as certain shots are set up, and basically I think the thing is you need to sprinkle them in and pace them. And that was one of the things that, you know, I felt the movie pulled off very successfully was that it sprinkled them in. You know, there weren't, you know, there was maybe two on top of one another every once in a while. But, you know, it was kind of sprinkled in throughout, which was, you know, kind of less in your face than, let's say, a theme park attraction.
Exactly. That's what I was sort of getting at. It didn't feel like it was just a gag reel of 3D effects one after another. I mean, there are obviously moments where it was great to use it. But to a certain extent, it felt like it was being a fun film first and not just a demo of what you could do stereoscopically. Now, there were some shots in there that would have caused problems, I'm sure. What were the sorts of major issues that you sort of had to deal with that were maybe less expected in terms of the 3D stereoscopic effect?
You know, I think, you know, one of the things that you end up dealing with is, you know, production issues. Obviously, production is on a schedule. They've got a certain number of pages that they need to get through in a day. And, you know, utilizing the Vince Pace rig, you know, I think one of the points that Eric makes is that they didn't have to shoot any differently or, you know, the rig really worked for them. That's one of the things that, you know, that if they did have a production problem, you know, that was one of the things that, you know, I'd like to solve. And the other thing was, is if there was a visual effects shot that needed something extra to complement the 3D to make it, you know, blend in a little bit better or something, you know, that's where I really feel the role of a stereo colorist, you know, is to basically help enhance the production quality, enhance the visual effects shots, and then basically, you know, do your job of, you know, making a nice picture that also, with working with the input from the DP, that creates certain moods and has shadowing and dimension, and especially in a 3D show, 3D dimension to it. So it's basically talking to all the creatives, you know, especially the DP, and going through and, you know, getting what did you have in mind when you shot this.
So was the film pretty much edited before you started doing any of the work, or were you sort of building your way through the film? In other words, was it lock off at reel at a time, or did you have like the whole film at rough lock straight away?
Now, because that the studio had purchased the gear, they basically took the money that they thought they would have to spend on the back end at a place like, you know, at one of the normal film labs. They took that money and invested it in the gear, four walling, and staff. So, you know, really what they wanted to do was what we came on was we came on right before the preview, maybe a month before the preview. We were putting together, you know, tables and chairs and things like that. And then we started ingesting based on a preliminary list, and then editorial locked the reels for the preview screening. And like I said, we whipped through the preview screening in about 2.5 weeks. And then it was great because it gave us an idea to basically suss out everything, you know, sussed out the workflow, sussed out what the film was going to be like, what the problems were. And then it gave us some time after that, after the preview screening, to go through and, you know, I went to Assimilate and gave them a list of tools. It's like, here's what I need. We talked to editorial. It's like, okay, if we do it this way next time, you know, it'll go much better. We talked to the vendors about, okay, next time when you send us this, you know, make sure that we get the files, you know, delivered, you know, in this manner, and it'll go, you know, a lot smoother. So it was kind of a nice experience to do that first preview screening, then reassess how we were going to do it. Then we basically started doing trailers for the show, and then we kind of delved into image processing issues, the other enhancements that would really, you know, make it, you know, make the images take it to the next level. And then we were able to concentrate as the reels locked with the director and editorial. Then we just went through, we used our image process materials, the visual effects shots finaled maybe 2 months before, you know, we kind of finished the DI. So, you know, it was a good, nice process that, you know, everybody felt comfortable that nobody had a gun to their head as far as what the rate of the room was, that, you know, we were into, you know, a golden hour room rate, or there was other clients or anything like that. And that's one of the real luxuries of, you know, having a cost-effective system, you know, like Scratch, that they were able to buy a couple units. The studio still owns them. They're using them on their current projects for mono projects and things like that. You know, I think, you know, Warner Brothers has a whole film, you know, DI division. You know, I went and saw a demo of the base light today, and, you know, they said that they have like 8 base lights over on the Warner Brothers lots doing restoration, all kinds of stuff. So, I mean, the color correction, the DI market, stereo isn't just going to be for post houses. There's going to be a lot of opportunities for the studios to maintain and keep this stuff in house. In fact, you know, all the animation houses are, you know, buying their own DI systems just so that they, you know, can keep the images in house. They can keep the art directors working there, and it's an interesting trend that as the Assimilate systems, Iridis systems, Nakoda, these lower cost platforms are available to the studios. But there's also, you know, the studios are buying base lights, lusters, and Pablos. And so there's a big range of products. And also, you know, I saw the base light 8 today. You know, big iron's back. You know, you can go out and spend $500,000 on something and have something that will play stereo 4K in real time, stacked with color corrections. And it's all because the box runs with 8 NVIDIA cards on it.
Well, let's get geeky for a second, because I like getting geeky. were they pulling convergence on set? Like, was there a lot of stereoscopic work done that was nailed, and you were, in the way that you pull focus, they were doing dynamic pulls on set?
Yeah, absolutely. Eric felt very strongly about that, and so it was basically a toe-in rig. You know, the choices is, you know, as we've discussed before, you have the choice between shooting parallel or toe-in. Eric and the pace and Vince Pace, and I believe Jim Cameron. You know, I don't have first-hand experience shooting with them, but normally the Pace rig will have a focus puller, a convergence puller, and you know, and the camera operator. And I actually saw a new term on IMDb the other day that it said volume camera operator. So that's actually the latest spin word. I'm also working with a guy on my current project, and his name is Phil Captain 3D McNally, and he earns his captain stripes. Where, you know, actually I think tomorrow I'm probably going to get the full stereo review of what he thought of Journey. So I'm looking forward to that. But you know, this whole idea of volume and how the dimension is built in the camera by the convergence puller. So, yeah, going back to the original question, there is a convergence puller on there. I did have to do some fixes where there was, like, Brendan was riding away in the bicycle in the very beginning of the movie, and the convergence puller was kind of chasing him and following him. But basically, I did it just like we do anything. I just keyframed the convergence so that I could, you know, kind of stabilize them, basically, so that, you know, I just could kind of smooth the move. But, yeah, the Eric would talk to the focus puller and the convergence operator and say, okay, we're going to pull focus here and we're going to converge here, all during this shot setup process and the rehearsals.
Now, the cameras that you were using were effectively, obviously, of a heritage in traditional HD. So were you working this on a linear or logarithmic workflow in terms of the color grading, and what sort of file formats were you dealing with that were being given to you in the scratch?
This was basically a Rec. 709 show, you know, all the way through. The cameras were set up Rec. 709. The grading theater was set up Rec. 709. And, you know, it was one of those things, knowing that there was going to be a film out, I was just always very careful to, you know, make sure that the blacks weren't crushed and that the whites weren't blown out, so that when they did a Rec. 709 to log conversion, that everything would, you know, just translate. And that was actually one of the very, you know, nice things about the project. When we went over to Technicolor to do the deliverables, you know, we put it up on the Real D, and as I said, we had mastered it with circular polarizers. When we put it up in a Real D theater, we were very close, and, you know, we could just kind of do an overall adjustment, and then we went through and basically spot checked to make sure that Eric was happy. Basically, I did a quick pass, and then we brought Eric in for a, you know, a quick 2-hour pass. You know, reviewed it, and then did some spot fixes. So we were able to, you know, spend almost, you know, only about 8 hours, I think, at Technicolor, two short 4-hour sessions going through and doing spot fixes, where, you know, normally you'd spend, I think with that show they would have probably spent, you know, over a month and a half maybe at Technicolor or, you know, at Photochem, you know, doing the entire film had it not been, you know, put together. And the rate that buying the equipment, Jonas said that, you know, they were very happy with the entire process. And I've seen quotes from some of the Walden executives that said what they first was going to, thought was going to be a technological quagmire and problem, actually ended up being a necessary luxury that you know, that they were all very happy that they could spend as much time in the theater that Walden had built.
So Jeff, the $64,000 question: if you're doing this again, how would you do it differently? Is there some major lessons that you've learned, because it is such a new area doing this full DI stereoscopic grading stuff? And would you use scratch again? I mean, where are you at?
You know, it all depends. It all depends where the studio's at. You know, if they have existing gear. I run multiple platforms. You know, I started out as a Luster guy. I did three independent films on the base light. And I'll tell you one thing. You know, just speaking, you know, where you want to have as many tools as you can at your disposal. You know, guys like you and I can sit down and, you know, we can go through and we can do mats and we can track and we can roto and we can stack up things and do these magnificent multi-level shots and fixes and resolves and things like that. You know, do you want to do that in the DI? Should you do that in the DI? Does the budget allow that? You know, for my, if it's not my money, I like a big, huge box, and I'll take as much horsepower as I can get. But it all comes down to return on investment for the studio, the post house. You know, can you bill out a room rate like that? But, you know, I always said, you know, I was asked a couple years ago, what tool, you know, would you want? And I said, flame, smoke, luster combo. Well, sure, that'd be $1 million, but I think that's what's happening is the higher end machines like the Pablo, you can do all your type fixes, you know, all your type and your graphic layout. You can do the entire movie open. You can do your paint fixes, your tracking, your dust bust on it. You can do everything on it, and you know, if you want to do everything, you know, sometimes I do, and you know, it all depends on the job.
And in terms of like actually capturing and stuff, was there anything about the way that it was just, you know, advice for other people that are looking at maybe getting involved if they were at a pre-production meeting and, you know, or you were at a pre-production meeting? Were there sort of lessons learned from this that you'd pass forward?
I would say get as much disk space as you can. Be as organized as you can. It's real important to talk to the software vendor about how the system deals best with stereo files. The how you lay out the files is very important. And I also would say that you know, do be vigilant about, you know, backing up your data, and, you know, all the normal things apply. You know, and a project where you're working in a tight time period. What we did was. We used a Bluefish card to do all the capturing on the you know, in the Assimilate software, and you know, it worked really well. There's other things you can use, clipsters, things like that. You know, it all depends on the budget and what existing equipment that the vendor. That the facility has, and what else the whatever vendor you're working with can provide. Every system's going to be different. The discrete stuff's using the Aja cards now. The Bluefish or Aja cards, you know, work with Scratch.
Actual panel did you have? You said they had the Bluefish card for the on the box, but Scratch doesn't come as standard with a. I mean. It takes a whole range of different panels. So, what was the actual user interface experience for you? What were you using?
I had the Tangent CP 200, the three set panels. So, you know, I had all the Tangent panels I could get with it, and you know, I recommend that, especially for a you know, for a full on suite like that, where you're making axis adjustments with the convergence, it's always much better to have a knob for it. I do like the new interfaces. That the base light interface is very nice. The new luster interface is pretty good. I think the Cadillac right now, you know, is probably some of the new DaVinci panels that you know, that they're coming out. That even the traditional DaVinci guys are putting pens in their hands.
Well, look, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us about the project. It really is pretty exciting. And are we allowed to ask what you're working on now?
Yep, I'm working at DreamWorks, and I'm working on Monster vs. Aliens, and that will be out in March 2009, and that is DreamWorks' first stereo animated film, and it'll be out March 2009.
Well, thanks so much, Jeff. Really appreciate it. See you.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, cool. That was a lot of fun. I really like Jeff. He's been a great fixture over at FX PhD with our stuff and also helping us out. And just the kind of work he's done, he worked on the Bronx's burning stuff and really did some cool stuff with on-set workflows with LUTs and grading and so forth.
Yeah, I must admit, it's something that's become of great interest to me lately is the on-set grading workflow stuff. We didn't really cover it in that interview because, as you said, that was stuff he was pioneering in Bronx is Burning. But I think with the advent of digital cinematography, be the stereoscopic or not, the on-set monitoring has just really changed, and it's continuing to change. People really want to see on-set almost a preview of what they're going to get in the grading situation without locking in anything on-set.
Yeah, that's the brilliant part of it. I mean, you can do, and I think the DOPs like it a lot too, because they can really help ensure that throughout the process that their vision is being seen. And of course, you do have the flexibility to change it as well in post regarding LUTs and make later decisions. So it's not all locked in, but it's a really radically changing and fast changing workflow in post, I think. So,
yeah, I think I'm right in saying that on Bronx is Burning, they actually used the gamma density stuff. And have you seen the gamma density stuff? We should follow up on that, I think, and meeting with those guys, because that's an on-set system that dovetails into the ACS CML, or the ACS being the American Cinematographers Association, and CML being the color decision list stuff. So did I say CML? Is it? Or CDL. Anyway, so the work that those guys are doing in terms of mapping out how the ACS CDL is carried down the line is pretty interesting.
Yeah, definitely something to keep tabs on moving forward. So,
you know, there's a thing about Chicago is that wherever I go, there are freaking sirens. It's like, I don't know, is it this like city is like constantly burning, or is it just that you guys?
It happens
like...
to be we have a major hospital and two fire stations within blocks of the FX PhD loft. So, yes, there are a few sirens everywhere. Don't be alarmed.
Is that County General? Can we go over to County General?
Yeah. ER.
One? Yeah. And that's at the bottom of the L, right? I know. I've seen it. I used to watch it religiously.
Well, speaking of the L, number one, we have to get prepped for Seagraph, but we're heading out to Wrigley Field now for your first Major League Baseball game in Chicago.
Yes. And you know what? It's like a cultural tour and a culinary tour. We had deep dish pizza the other night, which I swear to God is only made in one city in the world, which is here. And we're going to have hot dogs with some weird thing on it today. Relish, is it right? I don't know. I'm not allowed to have... John just like doesn't let me...
No, the ballpark is just really the basic ketchup and mustard.
Okay.
They break the rules but inside beer. The confines of Wrigley Field. But of course... Bad beer. So we are going to enjoy a little time this afternoon in preparation for all the work we've got coming up. And I'm really excited, again, as we mentioned, all the stuff that we've got coming out from Seagraph for FX Guy TV. And FX Guy TV is effectively back with a vengeance, I think.
Oh, yeah, totally. And we should do a shout-out for our new intern.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. David joined us just yesterday, actually moved to Chicago from North Carolina.
So poor bastard. Bit of a culture shock having both of us here.
Yeah, it was a little blindsided, I think, when he came in. But a good guy already, I can tell. He's going to work out great.
And just another thing, I want to thank the people at Hootenanny, because we had a function here last night, which we were talking at, and worked in conjunction with them. And they were just so generous and kind. It was a great function. Some really amazing meeting some of the people in the Chicago advertising. I think Chicago advertising is some of the best in the world, and it was great being able to meet those guys at the Hootenanny function. So thanks for that.
Yeah, it was fun having you here, and they enjoyed your Australian charm that you pulled out. We love the accent. We love the accent here.
Yeah, you know you guys have accents, right?
Oh, yes, we do.
Okay,
yeah.
Just to be clear about that. Yeah. Okay, so that's great. And we've got some amazing more array, as we said, of the stuff going on FX Guide TV. But let's not also forget our other podcasts. I'm on the VFX show, but they're going to talk about Red Center. Jason and I on Red Center. That's become a very popular podcast. So that and the normal stuff that we're doing on the site, the stuff has been just going off. It's been really, really successful. So thank you so much, guys, for listening and working with us, and we really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.